pains in others. Miss Agones, are you going to go first?
May it please the Court. The District Court made two key procedural errors in sentencing Derek Haynes. First, the District Court misapplied the minor role guideline, concluding solely based on the fact that Mr. Haynes was a police officer that he was not entitled to a minor role reduction. And second, the District Court did not address Mr. Haynes' argument that a two-level adjustment for his use of body armor should apply instead of a four-level adjustment. Turning first to the minor role guideline. The guideline itself and the cases interpreting it specifically require the District Court to engage in a comparison between the defendant and the other members of the conspiracy to determine whether the defendant is, quote, less culpable than most other participants. Here, the District Court and the government in opposing the reduction barely mentioned the other defendants at all. Instead, they relied only on the fact that Mr. Haynes was a police officer, a fact that is not indicative of his relative level of culpability in a conspiracy that consisted of at least four other police officers, as well as five laypersons who were intricately involved in planning and orchestrating the ripoffs that constitute the heart of this conspiracy. Additionally, the abuse of trust adjustment that Mr. Haynes received under 3B1.3 wholly and adequately compensates for the fact that as a police officer, he stands in a position of trust with the public and possibly brings special skills to bear on the crime. Had the District Court engaged in the comparison that is required by the guideline, it could not have reached the conclusion that Mr. Haynes was, quote, necessary to this conspiracy. As we explained in our sentencing memorandum, Mr. Haynes, in fact, was less culpable than other members because he was simply a follower. He had no role in orchestrating or planning any of these ripoffs, and in most cases, didn't even have prior knowledge and was simply called at the last minute. He didn't share in any proceeds of this conspiracy other than receiving a $500 payment, and even that came out of $7,000 that Corey Flagg recovered from the trunk of a car during an illegal stop.
What was his sentence relative to the other defendants?
He came right about in the middle, Your Honor. He was the fifth of 10 in terms of length. Mm-hmm. He was also minor compared to other members of the conspiracy if you consider the fact that he provided no material support to this conspiracy, unlike some other police officers who, for example, supplied a police cruiser or used a police database to run license plates. There was no evidence that Mr. Haynes did that. The forfeiture amounts are similarly indicative of his minor role in this conspiracy. He is liable for nothing, whereas the other members of this conspiracy are liable for amounts of $6,000 to upwards of $100,000. The District Court misapplied the guideline as a matter of law by not engaging in the required comparison. And if it had, it could not have reached the conclusion that Mr. Haynes was necessary. Turning next to the body armor adjustment, it remains a crucial first step in sentencing after Booker for the District Court to properly calculate the guideline range. And here we cannot be certain that the District Court properly calculated the range where it did not explain why the four-level body armor adjustment applied instead of the two-level adjustment. Now, the government argues the four-level adjustment applies clearly on its face because Mr. Haynes wore the body armor himself during the offense. However, the District Court nor the government supplied this rationale during sentencing. And it's irrelevant because the two-level adjustment also clearly applies on its face.
Well, what's your interpretation in the application note? Use means active employment in a manner to protect the person from gunfire.
Your Honor, we do not.
So wearing his body armor did protect him.
And we are not challenging that factual finding. In fact, what we're arguing is that the two-level adjustment can apply based on that factual finding. This offense, quote, involved the use of body armor. And the District Court was obligated to consider applying that two-level adjustment as a result.
I'm looking at the defendant used body armor.
Right.
And use is defined as active employment in a manner to protect the person from gunfire. So why doesn't that cover him?
It might cover him, Your Honor. But the District Court should have also considered whether to apply the two-level adjustment. If the defendant used body armor within
I don't understand. If 2B, defendant used body armor applies, there's no occasion to consider 2A.
Well, if the defendant used body armor, the offense necessarily involves the use of body armor.
And the guideline says apply the greater of, doesn't it? I'm sorry for interrupting, but it says apply the greater of, and if the greater of applies, that's what the judge was to use. Isn't that right?
To the extent that this falls within what this guideline was intended to punish, in this case, the four-level adjustment was a huge bump for Mr. Haynes because he was not even wearing the body armor in order to protect himself from legitimate law enforcement officers, which is what this guideline was designed to protect.
It doesn't say that. It says active employment in a manner to protect the person from gunfire. In other words, if you were holding the body armor in your arm or something like that, it wouldn't protect you from gunfire. But if you're wearing it, it does. That's in a manner to protect the person from gunfire.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's why we are not challenging the district court's conclusion that Mr. Haynes used body armor.
Yes, but then he has to get the four levels.
I think the district court would have been well within its discretion to apply the two-level adjustment instead, particularly where we are not.
But you started off by saying that the judge has to correctly calculate the guideline range, then he can depart. Well, a correct calculation, by your own argument, is four levels.
But
then
it would
he can
not
depart
have been incorrect.
Downward. Pardon?
I'm sorry. It would not have been incorrect to apply the two-level guideline.
Well, it wouldn't have been incorrect for him to deviate from the guideline sentence. The guideline sentence would have included the four levels. Now, is your argument he ignored arguments that Haynes made for a discount from the guideline sentence?
No, Your Honor. Mr. Haynes made the argument that the district court should apply the two-level guideline instead of the four levels.
Well, that's wrong. You've admitted the four level is the one that applies.
No, we don't. We admit that it might apply. The district court certainly never gave that rationale.
No, it might apply. It's active. No, because he used it.
But active employment goes to use, and use is also punished by the two-level guideline.
In a manner to protect the person from gunfire.
That's right, and that's use. But use is also punished by the two-level guideline.
A and B are quite different. One of them is use of body armor in the crime. The other is the defendant using it. Now, you admit the defendant was using it. If the defendant is using it, you get four levels.
We think the district court would have been well within its discretion to apply the two-level guideline.
No, what he might have done was to say this sentence, computed guideline sentence, is too harsh. That would not entitle him to misinterpret the guidelines. Would have entitled him to cut down the sentence.
And, in fact, we believe he should have.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Connors.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Barnett?
Please the court. On behalf of Mr. Jones, well, we could might as well cut to the chase. This appeal is concerned with whether or not body armor should be applied at all in the case of police officers. In this case, which is a little bit different from the prior argument, the core of the case is that the defendants used their position as Chicago police officers to accomplish the conspiracy. Which means they used the facilities, equipment, uniforms, guns, handcuffs, badges for a purpose. And the purpose of that being to enable them to stop drug dealers without the drug dealers suspecting that they were up to
right.
robbing them, obviously. Okay. Now, the issue is with the body armor, is whether or not that's unique in this case, because in this case that's a regular issue. I mean, police officers use body armor as part of their uniform, and since the specific offense characteristics as alleged in the indictment include that,
where I don't see that in the guidelines.
It would be under 3B15.
Yeah, I mean the guidelines. I mean the yeah in the guideline. Yeah, where is there anything about body armor in the specific offense characteristics?
Well, it does say the Enterprise of Chicago Police Department And they outline in the PSR.
Just answer me. Where in B is there anything about body armor? Specific offense characteristics?
No, there isn't. It just says the enhancement is for the use of body armor. There's nothing specifically in the indictment. What I'm saying is...
So are we talking about the same section we were talking about with Ms. Sagonis?
Yes.
Okay, then
What I'm focusing on, Your Honor, is the fact that the uniforms worn by Chicago police officers include body armor. And I'm suggesting...
I don't understand. So what?
Well, what I'm suggesting is this. A police officer, the whole idea is, in this case, is that as police officers, they wanted to stop drug dealers and get them, have the power and have those drug dealers trust that they are Chicago police officers.
You know that. I don't get your own point.
The point
what does
is...
What does it have to do with the body armor?
The body armor is part of the uniform.
So what?
Well, as part of the uniform, that would portray them to be police officers.
So if he wears a blue shirt and a tie or whatever police officers wear, it's the same as body armor?
It's part of the uniform, yes.
So in other words, a distinction between body armor and whatever else?
I don't think there is one in this case.
Would your argument apply to the gun as well?
Yes.
That's part of the uniform?
No, not the part of the uniform. It is the use of the gun. That's different. Part of the uniform? Absolutely.
But the possession of the gun is... part of the required duties.
Yes, absolutely. But look, I'm driving along, I see in my rearview mirror a police officer coming up in a squad car. And what do I believe right away? There's somebody in authority and power, I'm going to stop. I'm going to stop and I'm not going to resist. I'm not going to run. The whole idea of this case is what these officers were doing was exercising the power.
Police don't always wear body armor. They don't always, do they?
Yeah, well, they're fairly, yes.
They don't always wear body armor.
Well, I believe that they wear body armor quite often, Your Honor. It's part
That's
of the uniform.
That's very different from it's being part of their uniform. I don't see that.
Well, that's just a question of, you know, I don't know what to say, but it is part of the uniform. It's issued by the Chicago Police Department. It's worn quite regularly in the summer if you watch officers. They always have outside body armor on.
So your argument is that this enhancement for body armor excludes police officers. That's your argument.
Is that your argument? Yes, it is.
Do you have any basis for it?
This is a first case of first impression. I have none.
Okay, that's fine.
I think it's uniquely different in the case of policemen in this case.
What was Jones wearing?
He was wearing body armor.
Now, he was in callback position or something. What was his title?
Excuse me?
He was in some sort of a position where they took a lot of his authority away, but he was in a callback or some.
Yes, but.
What's that?
Well, they were going to, when they had to stop, they would call him and he would arrive at the scene. Or he would be part of the scene, part of the officers at the scene, and they have another party to come in. But the purpose of this, what I'm suggesting is, the officers were wearing this to effect a stop without resistance. It's contrary to the whole idea of the normal association of body armor and violence. They wanted to exercise authority so there'd be no resistance. Don't forget, they're dealing with drug dealers. You have a mental picture. A drug dealer knows exactly what to look for. If those criteria are not met, you're going to have some violence. They may say, well, maybe this isn't a police officer.
It's also pretty handy to have that body armor on when you're around drug dealers, isn't it? When you're trying to take things away from them?
Absolutely, but it's also handy to have a badge and a gun, and you know, so people you can exercise your authority properly. I mean,
Does the police department have guidelines on when police officers are to wear body armor?
They're a standard issue.
I know.
I don't know.
I don't know if
there are guidelines. I know that they're worn very often, but I'm not an expert on that. I don't know if there are guidelines.
Okay,
I just know that they're common.
Thank you very much, Mr. Barnett. Mr. Ackerman?
Good morning. If it pleases the court, I'm Alan Ackerman. I represent Euro Black. I will not discuss body armor. My client is serving 40 years based on what appears to be from the record dual events, the same dual events involving the government witness, former Officer Johnson. The facts are fairly straightforward. During the summer of 04, at some undefined date, Officers Johnson and Black, at the behest of Officer Jones, stopped a drug dealer, seized a kilo of cocaine. The drug dealer went on his way. Mr. Johnson got $6,000. Mr. Black got $6,000. We don't know what Mr. Jones got. At that point in time, during the summer of 04, it seems that Mr. Jones was at the callback center, as Judge Mannion indicated. On July 21, 2004, former Officer Jones set up another sting. This ironically involved a confidential informant of the Chicago Police Department. So this entire event was under surveillance by a group of officers and, I believe, at least one FBI agent.
But what, I'm sorry, what point are you trying to make?
Trying to make that the weapons in this particular case, which is the gravamen of a 40-year sentence, were never exposed, were never brandished, were never used. They probably were possessed. Now, I will agree with the government that taking the evidence in a light most favorable to the government, Bureau Black had his service revolver on both occasions. One occasion gives rise to an automatic consecutive five-year sentence. That's the summer of 04. And a 25-year sentence because of July 21, 04. The paucity of evidence regarding the weapon being, quote, used, brandished, or carried, which must be in relation to, is gone. There is no evidence of that. There is a paucity of evidence regarding was it possessed in furtherance of. In our reply brief, I point out that Circuit Judge Wood, speaking for the circuit, provided a caveat that every time a police officer with a weapon is involved in a drug-related offense or a offense of violence, that does not automatically give rise to 924 liability. I believe this is such a case. Now, my sister counsel will be discussing the question of whether this is a hub-spoke conspiracy. And in my reply brief, I apologize to the court because I believe there's de novo review here based on the post-trial motions and not plain error. And the citation for that is Judge Mannion's opinion in United States versus South, cited in the reply brief. What precious little time I have left, I will save for rebuttal, if any.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ackerman.
Thank you.
Ms. Lickup?
Taking my questions.
May it please the court. My name is Catherine Lickup, and I represent defendant appellant Brent Terry. Your honors, at trial in this case, the government began its closing statement by stating, "This is a case about dirty cops, Chicago police officers who abandoned and ignored their duties to the people of the city of Chicago." Your honors, my client, Brent Terry, is not a cop. He was not a member of the vast dirty cop conspiracy that the government alleged in this case. At most, the evidence at trial showed that Mr. Terry was involved in a single robbery at 87th and Michigan in September 2004.
Yep. So now are you complaining about a variance between the indictment and the conviction?
Yes, Your Honor, that is our first point. The government indicted Mr. Terry.
But you seem to agree that there's a harmless error.
No, Your Honor, we don't argue that the variance is harmless.
No, but don't you acknowledge that it could be harmless, or don't you? Does harmless error apply to variances from indictments? That's my question.
Yes, Your Honor, harmless error does apply, but in this case, Mr. Terry was prejudiced by the error for at least two reasons. First, there was no multiple conspiracies instruction issued in this case. And the circuit law in this circuit's law is that a multiple conspiracies instruction, if it is not given in a hub-and-spoke conspiracy as this one was, is plain error.
Would he have gotten a lighter sentence if he had just been convicted of the conspiracy he was involved in?
It's unclear whether or not that was the case. Mr. Terry was only sentenced for the particular robbery that he was involved in, Your Honor.
So how is he harmed by being found to have been involved in a larger conspiracy?
Well, one of the primary key issues why Mr. Terry was harmed, besides the failure to issue the multiple conspiracies instruction, therefore telling the jury to disregard any evidence that did not relate to Mr. Terry, was the admission of a wiretap call identified as call 2679. This was a call that occurred about 10 days after the 87th Michigan robbery, and it was between Mr. Jones and a third party named Ricky D. Now, the evidence at trial did not show that Mr. D was involved in any part of conspiracy involving Mr. Terry and Mr. Jones. The call is largely indecipherable, and it's reproduced at tab 9 of our brief. However, it is clear from the call that Mr. Jones was not seeking Mr. D's participation in any conspiracy involving Mr. Terry, nor was he recruiting Mr. D for any further conspiracies involving Mr. Terry.
No, but I thought you were acknowledging that Terry was guilty of the small conspiracy. And if so, and if that's all he was sentenced for, how is he hurt by this other evidence you mentioned?
That also goes to the wiretap call, Your Honor, because the wiretap call was one of the best pieces of evidence that the government had to prove that Mr. Terry had possessed 5 kilograms of cocaine. The remaining evidence in the case was insufficient to show that Mr. Terry could be shown beyond a reasonable doubt to be guilty of possessing at least 5 kilograms of cocaine. I would like to briefly address our second argument, which is with respect to the insufficiency of the evidence as to the firearm offense. Mr. Terry was convicted of this offense under a Pinkerton theory. Yet the evidence was insufficient at trial to show that Mr. Terry had any reasonable foreseeability that Mr. Flagg, another cop who was present at the 87th Michigan robbery, would be carrying, using, or possessing a weapon at that crime.
Well, surely he'd know he'd be carrying a gun, wouldn't he? He's a police officer?
No, Your Honor. Mr. Terry did not know that Mr. Flagg was even going to be present at the crime. And while it's clear that conspirators may be liable for what their co-conspirators may do that's foreseeable and overt and proven, in this case, there was no nexus between the firearm and the crime. The most the evidence at trial showed was that Mr. Flagg possessed his weapon, that he was carrying it in his waistband, but there was no other connection between Mr. Flagg's possession of that weapon and the crime here.
That's the argument that Mr. Ackerman and Ms. Adone.
Yes, Your Honor, but in this case, Mr. Terry was severely prejudiced because he was convicted under a Pinkerton theory, and clearly a dangerous precedent is set when a co-conspirator happens to be a Chicago police officer who is authorized to carry a service weapon. For these reasons, we respectfully ask that Mr. Terry's convictions be reversed and his case remanded for new trial.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cupp. Mr. Burke?
May it please the Court, Matt Burke on behalf of the United States. The first issue I'd like to address today, Your Honors, is the claimed variance brought by Brent Terry and Ural Black. There was no variance in this case, because the evidence was sufficient to show that both Brent Terry and Ural Black joined not simply the smaller conspiracy with Broderick Jones, but knowingly participated and joined the broader conspiracy charged in the second superseding indictment. Specifically with regard to Brent Terry, The evidence was not simply of one event, not simply of the ripoff of Marie Townsend in the last week of September of 2004. The government's evidence showed a long-standing agreement, not just on that date, about which there was considerable evidence, but in addition, the evidence included a recorded phone call on November 13, 2004, and that was the date of another attempted ripoff orchestrated by Broderick Jones, and specifically in which Ural Black agreed to participate. And hours after that failed ripoff, there was a recorded phone call between Broderick Jones and Brent Terry, where Broderick Jones tells Brent Terry, you know, look, we just tried to do it. It fell through. I was going to come at you, but it didn't go through. I got to go to work and find out more, but I'll get in touch with you soon. And Brent Terry says, all right, well, you know, just let me know. I'm still on board. It's not just the Marie Townsend ripoff or the failed ripoff on November 13, 2004. There's also evidence tying Brent Terry to the failed ripoff on July 21, 2004. Again, another ripoff that Ural Black himself participated in.
I'm curious about this notion of harmless error. And I mean, I realize you don't think there's a problem with the scope of the conspiracy, but I thought the reason there was a variance concern is that if the grand jury didn't actually indict the defendant for the crime of which he's convicted, then it bypasses the right to a, you know, to the screen that the grand jury provides under the Bill of Rights. So what am I missing? Because everyone seems to concede there's a harmless error defense.
Well, Your Honor, I think that your question, one of the factors, I think the way it's normally couched is that the variance issue proceeds in two steps. First is whether there was a variance, and then second, whether there was prejudice. And I think the second step, one of the considerations in the second step is the absence of notice to the defendant as to the charges. Now, that's not exactly
the same. I understand that. That's separate from the role of the grand jury as a preliminary step that's required to subject a person to jeopardy. So,
well, Your Honor, I haven't researched that issue and it wasn't raised, but I think the answer here is that I think the question of notice goes to how close is what is charged in the indictment to what is proven at trial. And I think that would encompass the concern that you're raising here with has the grand jury acted as a sufficient screen? Because if what's alleged in the indictment is sufficiently close to what's proven at trial, then they have functioned as the screen that you're talking about. And in any event, if the trial jury convicts and has found them guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, I think there's an argument there that cures any prejudice because of the failure of any screening function. But in this instance, you know, I believe that at a minimum, the events that were proven at trial, even under the defendant's theory, even if there was simply a narrower conspiracy, all of those allegations are subsumed within the indictment that the grand jury did return. So let's assume that there was a variance. The variance here is necessarily a subset of what is alleged in the indictment, and that indictment was found to be sufficient by the grand jury. So I don't think there's a screening problem here. There certainly hasn't been an argument that there is a failure of the grand jury to provide a screening function. And similarly, there's no variance with regard to Ural Black. The evidence showed not only that he joined the conspiracy, not only the narrow conspiracy with Broderick Jones, but that he knowingly joined in the broader conspiracy. It's not one event. It's a series of events over several months, three attempted ripoffs and one failed ripoff in the summer and fall of 2004. Again, a recorded phone call trying to set up the failed ripoff on November 13, 2004 between Broderick Jones and Ural Black, in which Broderick Jones tells him, you know, essentially, I'm working with other people. Not in those terms, but he says, you know, I need to call somebody, and I'll call you right back. And then he calls him back and says, We're still waiting for them to call us back. It's clear that Ural Black knows that he's conspiring not simply with Broderick Jones, but also with the other people who are helping to orchestrate these events. Regarding the question of prejudice, specifically Brent Terry's argument that he was prejudiced by this phone call, there's no prejudice for a number of reasons. Number one, even if there was a narrower conspiracy, even if the government's proof didn't prove the broadest possible conspiracy charged in the indictment, at a minimum, it proves that there's a standing agreement between Broderick Jones and Brent Terry that continues through November of 2004 after the Ricky D phone call, because we had the ripoff of Marie Townsend in the last week of September of 2004. We had the Ricky D phone call in October. We then have recorded phone calls in November of 2004 that prove that Brent Terry and Broderick Jones are continuing to conspire with one another. And the Ricky D phone call was in furtherance of even that narrow conspiracy, because Broderick Jones is recruiting another outlet to sell the drugs that are unlawfully obtained through this conspiracy. So even if the government proved only a narrow conspiracy, that conspiracy was ongoing at the time of the Ricky D phone call, and the Ricky D phone call furthered that conspiracy. So there's no prejudice, and again, the issue of quantity, as we pointed out in our brief, that's not an element of the offense. Brent Terry was sentenced below the default statutory minimum for any detectable quantity of cocaine, which is 20 years. His sentence was 168 months. So there's no Apprendi issue. There's ample evidence separate and apart from the Ricky D phone call proving that the Marie Townsend ripoff occurred, proving that the quantity was there, and proving that he engaged in the broader conspiracy. Similar with Ural Black, there's ample evidence about him. There's really no prejudice here. Regarding the 924C convictions, again, the nature of this conspiracy and the circumstantial evidence at trial showed that these guns were carried during and in relation to the crimes. Now, Ural Black's counsel has argued that it wasn't brandished, it wasn't pulled out. You don't need to prove brandishing. Carrying simply requires that it facilitate or have the potential to facilitate.
But their argument, which applies equally to the body armor and the gun, is that just goes with being a policeman. It's not, and there's an enhancement for police involvement. So they say it's double counting.
It's not double counting, Your Honor, because first of all, the government is not taking the position that any time a police officer has a gun that they're guilty of 924C.
Okay, what would be an example?
Well, if the police officer was hired to do something where the gun was purely there by coincidence, if they were acting as a lookout, or they were not engaged in some type of risky behavior where there was either a threat of violence or where their appearance as lawful police officers is not essential to the crime, they would not be guilty of violating Section 924C. But here,
are there any drug cases in which that would be plausible?
Well, I can't envision a situation in which a police officer is hired to rip off drug dealers, where the presence of the gun would not facilitate that. I think that's the key to this case, is the essence of this conspiracy is these police officers were hired to rip off drug dealers. And that entails at least two things. Number one, you need to look like a legitimate police officer. And as this court mentioned in Moore and in Patterson, where they're hired to appear to look like lawful police officers, that is sufficient evidence from which a jury reasonably could conclude that the gun facilitated the offense. And number two, what's going on in this instance is these are extremely risky endeavors. They're not, for example, in Moore, they're hired to escort drug dealers. Here, they're hired to rip them off. This is not a consensual transaction. There is a real threat that maybe the drug dealers decide they don't want to part with these drugs. And the defendants in this case know that this is illegal. They know they can't call for backup. They know it's extremely dangerous. And in particular, the Marie Townsend ripoff, we're talking about 10 kilograms of cocaine, $200,000 wholesale value. This court has held time and again that the drug industry is a very dangerous industry. And especially in this case, where the essence of this conspiracy was for them to rip off drug dealers. You know, they're taking these drugs against the victim's will. And the presence of the gun, the jury reasonably could have concluded that the presence of the gun either completed the illusion of the lawful police authority or emboldened them to participate in an endeavor that they knew was extraordinarily risky.
I'm worried. So you're talking about presence as opposed to somebody who's a lookout from a remote area or on a phone tipping people off. They're wearing a gun. It's irrelevant. If they're present with the druggers, then I suppose that's when it's...
Well, if they're present and they are carrying the gun, yeah. I think the question here is really whether it was during and in relation. There's no issue with carrying. The testimony was clear. They had the guns on their hips and thing in their holsters. So the question here, and I should also point out, Ural Black was convicted of two counts of 924C. He did not, in his opening brief, he did not challenge the first conviction, and so we didn't respond. But I'd like to point out the evidence at trial as to the first 924C conviction, he actually drew his gun. So that first ripoff that Ural Black participated in, even if simply leaving it in your holster wasn't enough, which we argue under the circumstance of this case it is, there he brandished the gun. He drew it. So the first count of conviction as to Ural Black, under any theory, he carried that in furtherance. But the in furtherance question, Judge Mannion, I believe the issue is, if they're just making phone calls and they happen to have a gun on their hip, and the gun doesn't facilitate or have the potential of facilitating in any way, then that's not a situation in which
the other guys can't see it.
Excuse me?
Bad guys can't see it. I guess they're all bad guys.
Well, I don't think the issue is whether the bad guys can see it or not, because the jury could still reasonably conclude that, well, the dirty cop knows he's got that gun.
All right, if it's concealed and he's got it.
It emboldens him.
He's carrying it in the presence of this transaction, whatever you want to call it, ripoff.
He's carrying it. He's in the presence of the transaction, and it's more than just that. I mean, he's going to the cars. He's pulling these. I mean, you're all black handcuffed, the targets in this case. They're pulled out of the car. He assists and he handcuffs them while he's wearing his gun. He knows that this is illegal. He knows they're trying to rip off drug dealers. He knows it's extremely dangerous. In that circumstance, those circumstances are sufficient from which a jury could conclude that the gun was carried during and in relation to the offense, and the evidence was sufficient on that point.
Did Terry get a body armor enhancement?
Your Honor, I actually don't know. I believe
because the offense involved the use of body armor, right? If Black was wearing the body armor.
Your Honor, I'm not sure whether or not Black was wearing body armor during the ripoff of Marie Townsend, and I'm
curious about the relation between the two and the four level subsections, because so suppose you have a conspiracy and you're not wearing the body armor, so you can only get an enhancement under subsection A. And you're with someone who is. But if you didn't know or have any reason to foresee that your co-conspirator was wearing body armor or would be wearing body armor, nevertheless, read literally, excuse me, you'd still be subject to this. That sounds a little strange.
I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor. I believe the two-level enhancement would be analyzed under the traditional rules of relevant conduct, as set forth in the initial provision, Chapter 1 of the guideline manual. And I believe if the event is not reasonably foreseeable to the defendant being sentenced, that in those circumstances, I think the defendant would not be held liable for the two-level
enhancement. I would think so. It's just that it doesn't say this. That's what bothers me.
It doesn't say it in Chapter 3. But I think all of Chapter 3 is, the general application principles of Chapter 1 would apply to all of the enhancements, including the body armor enhancement. And so the two-level enhancement would be subject to the general default rules of of relevant conduct. The four-level enhancement, the application note to the four-level enhancement specifically opts out of that and says it's narrower here. We're talking only about four-level enhancement applies only where the defendant personally did it or counseled or commanded someone else to do it. And so that's the distinction, and the distinction is clear. And as Judge Tinder pointed out, the guideline says you use the greater of the two or the four. They've agreed that he used it. He personally wore it. The district court made that finding. And so there really is no issue here at this point. The four-level enhancement was correct. If I may, I'd like to turn briefly to the minor role argument that Derek Haynes makes. The facts stipulated to by Derek Haynes in his plea agreement show that he did not play a minor role. I mean, he was sentenced on the basis of four events and only four events. And on those four events, his plea agreement establishes that he was absolutely essential and active participant. And I'll just give you a brief example. He participated in the unlawful invasion of Jerry Montgomery's home in September of 2004. Beforehand, he's talking with Broderick Jones. He's told all about it.
I don't know. What is the relevance of the fact that he was only involved in four incidents?
Well, Your Honor, what I'm saying is his offense level was calculated solely on the basis of those four events. He wasn't sentenced on the basis of other acts in furtherance of the conspiracy. So although he played no role in some acts in furtherance of the conspiracy, his offense level didn't take any of those acts.
I'm puzzled by that. So both Haynes and Terry apparently were sentenced on the basis of just a subset of conspiratorial behavior, even though they were found guilty of participating in the entire conspiracy. What is that about?
Your Honor, I do not believe the government's rationale for asserting that was a proper calculation. I'm not sure that the government's rationale for that is in the record. And I apologize. I don't know why it was that the government decided to sentence them in that fashion. But I know that, but at least with regard to Derek Haynes, his offense level was calculated solely on the basis of the events for which he personally participated. And in each of those four events, he was essential. The invasion of Jerry Montgomery's home, he met with Broderick Jones ahead of time. He was told by Broderick Jones what the plan was, that they believed that there was guns and drugs inside. Broderick Jones couldn't participate because Broderick Jones knew the victim, so he needed.
It's odd in a way because don't you have a Pinkerton? Isn't there a Pinkerton charge against one of these defendants?
Yes. And the Pinkerton charge is the 924C charge against Brent Terry, and he was convicted. And this arises out of the ripoff.
Why does he get Pinkerton and the others don't?
Well, because he participated personally in that event. The Pinkerton, the event that's at issue there is the ripoff of Marie.
I thought under Pinkerton that you, as a conspirator, you're liable for any crimes committed in furtherance of the conspiracy by your co-conspirators that you could have foreseen. Isn't that essentially it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But somehow the government pulled back in its recommendations for sentencing of Haynes and Haynes and Terry both. So I just don't know why.
Well, Your Honor, I
very insistent that Terry was part of the overall conspiracy, and yet in the sentencing he's treated as if he were just a participant in a much smaller conspiracy.
Your Honor, I'm not certain what the government's rationale was for taking that. I believe, it's a conservative approach, but I think with regard to the Marie Townsend ripoff, he personally participated in that event. He helped orchestrate that event.
Yeah, I understand.
And he called, the cops to the scene. It was reasonably foreseeable to him that Corey Flagg would show up with a gun. The plan was to rip people off.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Burke.
Thank you.
So, Ms. Agonis and Mr. Barnett, I think your time expired, but if you'd like a minute, you can each have that, and then Mr. Ackerman and Ms. Lookup have an entitlement to additional
Thank you, Your Honor. Just very briefly, the government says that Mr. Haynes was essential and active in those four events, but what the government is missing is that the district court never made any comparison between Mr. Haynes and any other members who were present, even at those just those four events. The government also raises the September 4 ripoff. Well, Broderick Jones tried to get two or three other police officers there. Mr. Haynes was a last resort, which shows that he is not an integral part of this conspiracy. And in July, the July 04 ripoff, that ripoff failed. Mr. Haynes went back to work, and Mr. Jones reconstituted the team later that day with new members of the conspiracy. So to say that Mr. Haynes was essential at any of these particular events is simply not accurate. He might have been helpful at the particular time he was there, but rest assured that those same ripoffs were planned for later on with or without the assistance of Mr. Haynes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gomez. Mr. Barnett, nothing further? Okay. Mr. Ackerman?
Thank you. I disagree with my brother from the government regarding some of the facts, but be that as it may, they are fleshed out in the briefs.
The government maintains that just having the weapon is adequate for 924C if there is a drug offense. The court insightfully asked, is there an example of a case where perhaps it would not give rise to 924C liability? And the government said something like, if I heard it right, perhaps if there was an officer on a lookout or some such thing, maybe that would not. To please the court, the government's wrong. They specifically and always argue in arrest, warrantless arrest situations, that just because an officer had a gun, it was not drawn or exposed, and therefore the person should not have been afraid or been free to leave and so forth. The government cannot have it both ways. Here, there clearly was no exposure of any weapon on July 21, 2004. Mr. Johnson got 9 years. Mr. Black got 40. Of the 40, 25 years has to do with a single event. The government makes no comment on that, and I thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ackerman. And Ms. Lickup? Actually, I had a question for you, though. I had a question, but I forgot. I'm sorry. Okay. So, anyway, let me thank particularly Ms. Agones and Ms. Lickup. You were the appointed counsel, were you not? So we thank you very much for your efforts on behalf of your client, but we thank all of the counsel for their arguments and briefs. And the court is going to take a brief recess.